so that their expertise could correct the tactical inequity. And that had worked twice. But would it continue to work? So, for starters, John decided, from now on a more senior Rainbow member would always accompany the teams into the field to provide support, someone the team leaders could lean against. Of course, they wouldn't like the oversight right there at their shoulders, but that couldn't be helped. With that thought, he dismissed the meeting and called Al Stanley into his office, where he presented his idea.
"Fine with me, John. But who are the seniors who go out?"
"You and me, for starters."
"Very well. Makes sense. What with all the fitness and shooting training we subject ourselves to? Domingo and Peter might find it all a bit overpowering, however.
They both know how to follow orders, and they'll come to us for advice when it's needed. Everybody does. I sure did, whenever the opportunity offered itself."
Which hadn't been very damned often, though John remembered wishing for it often enough.
"I agree with your proposal, John," Stanley said. "Shall we write it up for the order book?"
Clark nodded. "Today."
Chapter 9. Stalkers.
"I can do that, John," the director of Central Intelligence said. "It means talking to the Pentagon, however."
"Today, if possible, Ed. We really need this. I was remiss in not considering the need earlier. Seriously remiss," Clark added humbly.
"It happens," DCI Foley observed. "Okay, let me make some calls and get back to you."
He broke the connection and thought for a few seconds, then flipped through his Rolodex, and found the number of Sink Snake, as the post was laughingly called. Commander-in-Chief, Special Operations Command at MacDill Air Force Base outside Tampa, Florida, was the boss of all the Snake Eaters, the special operations people from whom Rainbow had drawn its American personnel. General Sam Wilson was the man behind the desk, not a place he was especially comfortable. He'd started off as an enlisted man who'd opted for airborne and ranger training, then moved into special forces, which he'd left to get his college degree in history at North Carolina State University, then returned to the Army as a second lieutenant and worked his way up the ladder rapidly. A youthful 53, he had 4 shiny stars on his shoulders now and was in charge of a unified multi-service command that included members from each of the armed services, all of whom knew how to cook snake over an open fire.
"Hi, Ed," the general said, on getting the call over his secure phone. "What's happening at Langley?"
The special operations community was very close with CIA, and often provided intelligence to it, or the muscle to run a difficult operation in the field.
"I have a request from Rainbow," the DCI told him.
"Again? They've already raided my units, you know."
"They've put 'em to good use. That was their takedown in Austria yesterday."
"Looked good on TV," Sam Wilson admitted. "Will I get additional information?"
By which he meant information on who the bad guys had been.
"The whole package when it's available, Sam," Foley promised.
"Okay. What does your boy need?"
"Aviators. Helicopter crews."
"You know how long it takes to train those people, Ed? Jesus, they're expensive to maintain, too."
"I know that, Sam," the voice assured him from Langley. "The Brits have to put up, too. You know Clark. He wouldn't ask unless he needed it."
Wilson had to admit that, yes, he knew John Clark, who'd once saved a wrecked mission, and in the process a bunch of soldiers, a long time and several presidents ago. Ex-Navy SEAL, the agency said of him, with a solid collection of medals and a lot of accomplishments. And this Rainbow Group had 2 successful operations under its belt.
"Okay, Ed. How many?"
"1 really good one for now."
It was the for-now part that worried Wilson. But...
Okay, I'll be back to you later today.
Thanks, Sam.
One nice thing about Wilson, Foley knew, was that he didn't screw around on time issues. For him, right now meant right the hell now.
Chester wasn't going to make it even as far as Kilgore had thought. His liver function tests were heading downhill faster than anything he'd ever seen, or read about in the medical literature. The man's skin was yellow now, like a pale lemon, and slack over his flaccid musculature. Respiration was already a little worrisome, too, partly because of the large dose of morphine he was getting to keep him unconscious, or at least stuporous. Both Kilgore and Barbara Archer had wanted to treat him as aggressively as possible, to see if there were really a treatment modality that might work on Shiva. But the fact of the matter was that Chester's underlying medical conditions were so serious that no treatment regimen could overcome both those problems and the Shiva.
2 days, Kilgore said. Maybe less.
I'm afraid you're right, Dr. Archer agreed.
She had all manner of ideas for handling this, from conventional, and almost certainly useless, antibiotics, to interleukin-2, which some thought might have clinical applications to such a case. Of course, modern medicine had yet to defeat any viral disease, but some thought that buttressing the body's immune system from one direction might have the effect of helping it in another. And there were a lot of powerful new synthetic antibiotics on the market now. Sooner or later, someone would find a magic bullet for viral diseases. But not yet.
Potassium? She asked,
after considering the prospects for the patient and the negligible value of treating him at all. Kilgore shrugged agreement.
I suppose.
You can do it if you want.
Kilgore waved to the medication cabinet in the corner.
Dr. Archer walked over, tore a 40cc disposable syringe out of its paper and plastic container, then inserted the needle in a glass vial of potassium and water solution, and filled the needle by pulling back on the plunger. Then she returned to the bed and inserted the needle into the medication drip, pushing the plunger now to give the patient a hard bolus of the lethal chemical. It took a few seconds, longer than if she had done the injection straight into a major vein, but Archer didn't want to touch the patient any more than necessary, even with gloves. It didn't really matter that much. Chester's breathing within the clear plastic oxygen mask seemed to hesitate, then restart, then hesitate again, then become ragged and irregular for 6 or 8 breaths. Then... it stopped. The chest settled into itself and didn't rise. His eyes had been semi-open, like those of a man in shallow sleep or shock, aimed in her direction but not really focused. Now they closed for the last time. Dr. Archer took her stethoscope and held it on the alcoholic's chest. There was no sound at all. Archer stood up, took off her stethoscope, and pocketed it.
So long, Chester, Kilgore thought.
Okay, she said matter-of-factly. Any symptoms with the others?
Not yet.
Antibody tests are positive, however, Kilgore replied.
Another week or so before we see frank symptoms, I expect.
We need a set of healthy test subjects, Barbara Archer said. These people are too sick to be proper benchmarks for Shiva.
Well, that means some risks.
I know that, Archer assured him. And you know we need better test subjects.
Yes, but the risks are serious, Kilgore observed.
And I know that, Archer replied.
Okay, Barb, run it up the line.
I won't object.
You want to take care of Chester?
I have to run over to see Steve.
Fine.
She walked to the wall, picked up the phone, and punched 3 digits onto the keypad to
to get the disposal people. For his part, Kilgore went into the changing area. He stopped in the decontamination chamber first of all, pushed the large square red button, and waited for the machinery to spray him down from all directions with the fog solution of antiseptics that were known to be immediately and totally lethal to the Shiva virus. Then he went through the door into the changing room itself, where he removed the blue plastic suit, tossed it into the bin for further and more dramatic decontamination. It wasn't really needed, but the people in the lab felt better about it then. Then dressed in surgical greens. On the way out, he put on a white lab coat. The next stop was Steve Berg's shop. Neither he nor Barb Archer had said it out loud yet, but everyone would feel better if they had a working vaccine for Shiva. "Hey, John," Berg said, when his colleague came in. "Morning, Steve," Kilgore responded in greeting. "How are the vaccines coming?" "Well, we have A and B working now." Berg gestured to the monkey cages on the other side of the glass. "A batch has the yellow stickers. B is the blue, and the control group is red." Kilgore looked. There were 20 of each, for a total of 60 rhesus monkeys. Cute little devils. "Too bad," he observed. "I don't like it either, but that's how it's done, my friend." Neither man owned a fur coat. "When do you expect results?" "Oh, 5 to 7 days for the A group, 9 to 14 for the control group, and the B group. Well, we have hopes for them, of course. How's it going on your side of the house?" "Lost one today." "This fast?" Berg asked, finding it disturbing. "His liver was off the chart to begin with. That's something we haven't considered fully enough. There will be people out there with an unusually high degree of vulnerability to our little friend." "They could be canaries, man," Berg worried, thinking of the songbirds used to warn miners about bad air. "And we learned how to deal with that 2 years ago, remember?" "I know." In a real sense, that was where the entire idea had come from. But they could do it better than the foreigners had. "What's the difference in time between humans and our little furry friends?" "Well, I didn't aerosol any of these, remember. This is a vaccine test, not an infection test." "Okay, I think you need to set up an aerosol control test. I hear you have an improved packing method." "Maggie wants me to do that." "Okay. We have plenty of monkeys. I can set it up in 2 days. A full-up test of the notional delivery system." "With and without vaccines?" "I can do that," Berg nodded. "You should have set it up already, idiot," Kilgore didn't say to his colleague. Berg was smart, but he couldn't see very far beyond the limits of his microscopes. Well, nobody was perfect, even here. "I don't go out of my way to kill things, John," Berg wanted to make clear to his physician colleague. "I understand, Steve, but for every one we kill in proofing Shiva, we'll save a few hundred thousand in the wild, remember? And you take good care of them while they're here," he added. The test animals here lived an idyllic life, in comfortable cages, or even in large communal areas where the food was abundant and the water clear. The monkeys had a lot of room, with pseudo-trees to climb, air temperature like that of their native Africa, and no predators to threaten them. As in human prisons, the condemned got hearty meals to go along with their constitutional rights. But people like Steve Berg still didn't like it, important and indispensable as it was to the overall goal. Kilgore wondered if his friend wept at night for the cute little brown-eyed creatures. Certainly, Berg wasn't all that concerned with Chester, except that he might represent a canary, of course. That could indeed ruin anything, but that was also why Berg was developing a vaccine. "Yeah," Berg admitted. "I still feel shitty about it, though." "You should see my side of the house,"
Kilgore observed. I suppose, Steve Berg responded diffidently.
The overnight flight had come out of Raleigh-Durham International Airport in North Carolina, an hour's drive from Fort Bragg. The Boeing 757 touched down in an overcast drizzle to begin a taxi process almost as long as the flight itself, or so it often seemed to the passengers, as they finally came to the U.S. Airways gate in Heathrow's Terminal 3. Chavez and Clark had come up together to meet him. They were dressed in civilian clothes, and Domingo held a card with Malloy printed on it. The fourth man off was dressed in Marine Class A's, complete to his Sam Brown belt, gold wings, and 4.5 rows of ribbons on the olive-colored uniform blouse. His blue-gray eyes saw the card and came to it as he half-dragged his canvas bag with him.
"Nice to be met," Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Malloy observed. "Who are you guys?"
"John Clark."
"Domingo Chavez."
Handshakes were exchanged.
"Any more bags?" Ding asked.
"This is all I had time to pack."
"Lead on, people," Colonel Malloy replied.
"Need a hand with that?" Chavez asked a man about 6 inches taller and 40 pounds heavier than himself.
"I got it," the Marine assured him.
"Where are we going?"
"Chopper is waiting for us. Car is this way."
Clark headed through a side door, then down some steps to a waiting car. The driver took Malloy's bag and tossed it in the boot for the half-mile drive to a waiting British Army Puma helicopter. Malloy looked around. It was a crummy day to fly, the ceiling about 1,500 feet, and the drizzle getting a little harder. But he was not a white-knuckle flyer. They loaded into the back of the helicopter. He watched the flight crew run through the startup procedure professionally, reading off their printed checklist, just as he did it. With the rotor turning, they got on the radio for clearance to lift off. That took several minutes. It was a busy time at Heathrow, with lots of international flights arriving to deliver business people to their work of the day. Finally, the Puma lifted off, climbed to altitude, and headed off in an undetermined direction to wherever the hell he was going. At that point, Malloy got on the intercom.
"Can anybody tell me what the hell this is all about?"
"What did they tell you?"
"Pack enough underwear for a week," Malloy replied with a twinkle in his eye.
"There's a nice department store a few miles from the base."
"Hereford?"
"Good guess," Chavez responded. "Been there?"
"Lots of times. I recognize that crossroads down there from other flights."
"Okay, what's the story?"
"You're going to be working with us, probably," Clark told him.
"Who's us, sir?"
"We're called Rainbow, and we don't exist."
"Vienna?"
Malloy said through the intercom.
The way they both blinked was answer enough.
"Okay, that looked a little slick for cops.
What's the makeup of the team?"
"NATO. Mainly Americans and Brits, but others too. Plus an Israeli," John told him.
"And you set this up without any rotor heads?"
"Okay, goddammit, I blew it, okay," Clark observed.
"I'm new at this command stuff."
"What's that on your forearm, Clark?"
"Oh, what rank are you?"
John pulled back on his jacket, exposing the red seal tattoo.
"I'm a simulated 2-star. Ding here is a simulated major."
The Marine examined the tattoo briefly.
"I've heard of those, but never seen any. 3rd Special Operations Group, wasn't it? I knew a guy who worked with them."
"Who's that?"
"Dutch Voort. Retired about 5-6 years ago as a full bird."
"Dutch Voort? Shit, haven't heard that name in a while," Clark replied at once.
"I got shot down with him once."
"You and a bunch of others. Great aviator, but his luck was kinda uneven."
"How's your luck, Colonel?" Chavez asked.
"Excellent, sonny. Excellent," Malloy assured him.
"And you can call me Bear."
It fit, both men decided of their visitor.
He was Clark's height, 6'1", and bulky, as though he pumped barbells for fun and drank his share of beer afterward. Chavez thought of his friend Julio Vega, another lover of free weights. Clark read over the medals. The DFC had two repeat clusters on it, as did the Silver Star. The shooting iron also proclaimed that Malloy was an expert marksman. Marines liked to shoot for entertainment and to prove that, like all other Marines, they were riflemen. In Malloy's case, a distinguished rifleman, which was as high as the awards went. But no Vietnam ribbons, Clark saw. Well, he would have been too young for that, which was another way for Clark to realize how old he'd grown. He also saw that Malloy was about the right age for a half-colonel, whereas someone with all those decorations should have made it younger. Had Malloy been passed over for full-bird colonel? One problem with special operations was that it often put one off the best career track. Special attention was often required to make sure such people got the promotions they merited, which wasn't a problem for enlisted men, but frequently a big one for commissioned officers. I started off in search and rescue, then I shipped over to Recon Marines, you know, get 'em in, get 'em out. You gotta have a nice touch. I guess I do. What are you current in? H-60, Hueys, of course, and H-53s. I bet you don't have any of those, right? Afraid not, Chavez said, immediately and obviously disappointed. Air Force 24th Special Operations Squadron at RAF Mildenhall has the MH-60K and MH-53. I am up to speed on both if you ever borrow them. They're part of 1st Special Operations Wing, and they're based both here and in Germany last time I checked. No shit? Clark asked. No shit, simulated general, sir. I know the wing commander, Stanislaus Dubrovnik. Stan the man. Great helo driver. He's been around the block a few dozen times if you ever need a friend in a hurry. I'll keep that in mind. What else you know how to fly? The Night Stalker, of course, but not many of them around. None based over here that I know of. The Puma turned then, circling, then flaring to settle into the Hereford pad. Malloy watched the pilot's stick work and decided he was competent, at least for straight and level stuff. I'm not technically current on the MH-47 Chinook. We're only allowed to stay officially current on three types. Technically, I'm not current on Hueys either, but I was fucking born in a Huey, if you know what I mean, General. And I can handle the MH-47 if I have to. The name's John, Mr. Bear, Clark said with a smile. He knew a pro when he saw one. I'm Ding. Once upon a time I was an 11 Bravo, but then the agency kidnapped my ass. His fault, Chavez said. John and I've been working together a while. I suppose you can't tell me the good stuff, then. Kinda surprised I never met you guys before. I've delivered a few spooks here and there from time to time, if you know what I mean. Bring your package? Clark asked, meaning his personnel file. Malloy patted his bag. Yes, sir. And very creative writing it is, if I do say so. The helicopter settled down. The crew chief jumped out to pull the sliding doors open. Malloy grabbed his bag, stepped down, and walked to the rover parked just off the pad. There the driver, a corporal, took Malloy's bag and tossed it in the back. British hospitality, Malloy saw, hadn't changed very much. He returned the salute and got in the rear. The rain was picking up. English weather, the colonel thought, hadn't changed much either. Miserable place to fly helicopters, but not too bad if you wanted to get real close without being seen. And that wasn't too awful, was it? The rover jeep took them to what looked like a headquarters building instead of his guest housing. Whoever they were in a hurry. "Nice office, John," he said, looking around on the inside. "I guess you really are a simulated two-star." "I'm the boss," Clark admitted, "and that's enough. Sit down. Coffee?" "Always," Malloy confirmed.
taking a cup a moment later.
"Thanks."
"How many hours?" Clark asked next.
"Total?"
6,742 last time I added it up. 3,100 of that is special operations. And, oh, about 500 combat time.
That much?
Grenada, Lebanon, Somalia, couple of other places. And the Gulf War. I fished 4 fast-mover drivers out and brought them back alive during that little fracas. One of them was a little exciting, Malloy allowed. But I had some help overhead to smooth things out. You know, the job's pretty boring if you do it right.
I'll have to buy you a pint, Bear, Clark said. I've always been nice to the SAR guys.
And I never turn down a free beer.
The Brits in your team, ex-SAS?
Mainly. Worked with them before.
Exercises, here and over at Bragg.
They are okay troops, right up there with Force Recon and my pals at Bragg.
This was meant to be generous, Clark knew, though the local Brits might take slight umbrage at being compared to anyone.
Anyway, I suppose you need a delivery boy, right?
Something like that.
Ding, let's run Mr. Bear through the last field operation.
Roger, Mr. C.
Chavez unrolled the big photo of the Schloss Ostermann on Clark's conference table and started his brief, as Stanley and Covington came in to join the conference.
"Yeah," Malloy said when the explanation ended. "You really did need somebody like me for that one, guys."
He paused.
"Best thing would be a long rope deployment to put 3 or 4 on the roof. Right about here," he tapped the photo.
"Nice flat roof to make it easy."
"That's about what I was thinking. Not as easy as a zip line, but probably safer," Chavez agreed.
"Yeah, it's easy if you know what you're doing. Your boys will have to learn to land with soft feet, of course, but nice to have 3 or 4 people inside the castle when you need 'em. From how good the takedown went, I imagine your people know how to shoot and stuff."
"Fairly well," Covington allowed in a neutral voice.
Clark was taking a quick riffle through Malloy's personnel file, while Chavez presented his successful mission. Married to Francis Nay Hutchins Malloy, he saw, 2 daughters, 10 and 8. Wife was a civilian nurse working for the Navy.
Well, that was easy to fix. Sandy could set that up at her hospital pretty easy.
Lieutenant Colonel Dan Malloy, U.S. Marine Corps, was definitely a keeper. For his part, Malloy was intrigued. Whoever these people were, they had serious horsepower. His orders to fly to England had come directly from the office of Sink Snake himself, Big Sam Wilson, and the people he'd met so far looked fairly serious. The small one, Chavez, he thought, was one competent little fucker, the way he'd walked him through the Vienna job, and from examining the overhead photo, his team must have been pretty good, too. Especially the two who'd crept up to the house to take the last bunch of bad guys in the back. Invisibility was a pretty cool gig if you could bring it off, but a fucking disaster if you blew it. The good news, he reflected, was that the bad guys weren't all that good at their field craft. Not trained like his Marines were. That deficiency almost canceled out their viciousness. But not quite. Like most people in uniform, Malloy despised terrorists as cowardly, subhuman animals who merited only violent and immediate death. Chavez next took him to his team's own building, where Malloy met his troops, shook hands, and evaluated what he saw there. Yeah, they were serious, as were Covington's Team One people in the next building over. Some people just had the look. The relaxed intensity that made them evaluate everyone they met, and decide at once if the person was a threat. It wasn't that they liked killing and maiming, just that it was their job, and that job spilled over into how they viewed the world. Malloy they evaluated as a potential friend, a man worthy of their trust and respect, and that warmed the Marine aviator. He'd be the guy whom they had to trust to get them where they needed to be quickly, stealthily, and safely, and then get them out in the same way.
The remaining tour of the training base was pure vanilla to one schooled in the business. The usual buildings, simulated airplane interiors, three real railroad passenger cars, and the other things they practiced to storm. The weapons range with the pop-up targets. He'd have to play there himself to prove that he was good enough to be here, Malloy knew, since every special ops guy was and had to be a shooter, just as every Marine was a rifleman. By noon, they were back in Clark's headquarters building.
"Well, Mr. Bear, what do you think?" Rainbow Six asked.
Malloy smiled as he sat down.
"I think I'm seriously jet-lagged, and I think you have a nice team here."
"So, you want me?"
Clark nodded.
"I think we do, yes. Start tomorrow morning?"
"Flying what?"
"I called that Air Force bunch you told us about. They're going to lend us an MH-60 for you to play with."
"Neighborly of them."
That meant to Malloy that he'd have to prove that he was a good driver. The prospect didn't trouble him greatly.
"What about my family? Is this TAD or what?"
"No, it's a permanent duty station for you. They'll come over on the usual government package."
"Fair enough. Will we be getting work here?"
"We've had two field operations so far, Bern and Vienna. There's no telling how busy we'll be with four real operations, but you'll find the training regimen is pretty busy here."
"Suits me, John."
"You want to work with us?"
The question surprised Malloy.
"This is a volunteer outfit?"
Clark nodded.
"Every one of us."
"Well, how about that?"
"Okay," Malloy said, "you can sign me up."
"May I ask a question?" Popoff asked in New York.
"Sure," the boss said, suspecting what it would be.
"What is the purpose of all this?"
"You really do not need to know at this time," was the expected reply to the expected question. Popoff nodded his submission/agreement to the answer.
"As you say, sir. But you are spending a goodly amount of money for no return that I can determine."
Popoff raised the money question deliberately to see how his employer would react. The reaction was genuine boredom.
"The money is not important."
And though the response was not unexpected, it was nonetheless surprising to Popoff. For all of his professional life in the Soviet KGB, he'd paid out money in niggardly amounts to people who'd risk their lives and their freedom for it, frequently expecting far more than they'd ever gotten, because often enough the material and information given was worth far more than they'd been paid for it. But this man had already paid out more than Popoff had distributed in over 15 years of field operations. For nothing. For two dismal failures. And yet there was no disappointment on his face, Dmitri Arkadyevich saw. What the hell was this all about?
"What went wrong in this case?" the boss asked.
Popoff shrugged.
"They were willing, but they made the mistake of underestimating the skill of the police response. It was quite skillful indeed," he assured his employer.
"More so than I expected, but not that great a surprise. Many police agencies across the world have highly trained counter-terror groups."
"It was the Austrian police?"
"So the news media said. I did not press my investigation further."
"Should I have done so?"
A shake of the head.
"No, just idle curiosity on my part."
"So you don't care if these operations succeed or fail," Popoff thought. "Then why the hell do you fund them?" There was no logic to this, none at all. That would have been, should have been, troubling to Popoff. Yet it was not seriously so. He was becoming rich on these failures. He knew who was funding the operations, and had all the evidence, the cash, he needed to prove it.
So this man could not turn on him. If anything, he must fear his employee, mustn't he? Popov had contacts in the terrorist community, and could as easily turn them against the man who procured the cash, couldn't he? It would be a natural fear for this man to hold, Dmitri reflected. Or was it? What, if anything, did this man fear? He was funding murder. Well, attempted murder in the last case. He was a man of immense wealth and power, and such men feared losing those things more than they feared death. It kept coming down to the same thing, the former KGB officer told himself. What the hell was this all about? Why was he plotting the deaths of people, and asking Popov to? Was he doing this to kill off the world's remaining terrorists? Did that make sense? Using Popov as a stalking horse, an agent provocateur, to draw them out and be dealt with by the various countries' highly trained counter-terror teams? Dmitri decided that he'd do a little research on his employer. It ought not to be too hard, and the New York Public Library was only 2 kilometers distant on Fifth Avenue. What sort of people were they? Whom do you mean? Popov asked. Dortmund and Ferkner, the boss clarified. Fools. They still believed in Marxism-Leninism. Clever in their way, intelligent in the technical sense, but their political judgment was faulty. They were unable to change when their world changed. That is dangerous. They failed to evolve, and for that they died. It wasn't much of an epitaph, Popov knew. They'd grown up studying the works of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels and all the rest. The same people whose words Popov had studied through his youth. But even as a boy, Popov had known better. And his world travels as a KGB officer had merely reinforced his distrust for the words of those 19th-century academicians. His first flight on an American-made airliner, chatting in a friendly way with the people next to him, had taught him so much. But Hans and Petra? Well, they'd grown up within the capitalist system, sampled all of its wares and benefits, and nevertheless decided that theirs was a system bereft of something that they needed. Perhaps, in a way, they'd been as he had been, Dmitri Arkadyevich thought. Just dissatisfied, wanting to be part of something better. But no, he'd always wanted something better for himself, whereas they'd always wanted to bring others to paradise, to lead and rule as good communists. And to reach that utopian vision, they'd been willing to walk through a sea of innocent blood. Fools. His employer, he saw, accepted his more abbreviated version of their lost lives, and moved on. Stay in the city for a few days. I will call you when I need you. As you say, sir. Popov stood and left the office, and caught the next elevator to street level. Once there, he decided to walk south to the library with the lions in front. The exercise might clear his head, and he still had a little thinking to do. When I need you, could mean another mission, and soon.
Irvin? George? How are you, my friend?
It has been an eventful week, Osterman admitted. His personal physician had him on tranquilizers, which he thought didn't work very well. His mind still remembered the fear. Better yet, Ursel had come home, arriving even before the rescue mission. And that night, he'd gotten to bed just after 4 in the morning. She'd come to bed with him, just to hold him. And in her arms he'd shaken and wept from the sheer terror that he'd been able to control right up to the moment that the man Ferkner had died less than a meter to his left. There was blood and other tissue particles on his clothing. They'd had to be taken off for cleaning. Dengler had had the worst time of all, and wouldn't be at work for at least a week, the doctors said. For his part, Osterman knew that he'd be calling that Britisher who'd come to him with the security proposal, especially after hearing the voices of his rescuers.
"Well, I can't tell you how pleased I am that you got through it, okay, Irvin?"
"Thank you, George," he said to the American Treasury Secretary. "Do you appreciate your bodyguards more today than last week?"
"You bet. I expect that business in that line of work will be picking up soon."
"An investment opportunity?" Osterman asked with a forlorn chuckle.
"I didn't mean that," Winston replied with an almost laugh. "It was good to laugh about it, wasn't it?"
"George?"
"Yeah?"
"They were not Austrian, not what the television and newspapers said. And they told me not to reveal this, but you can know this. They were Americans and British."
"I know, Irvin. I know who they are. But that's all I can say.
I owe them my life. How can I repay such a debt?"
"That's what they are paid to do, my friend. It's their job."
"Vielleicht. But it was my life they saved, and those of my employees. I have a personal debt to pay them. Is there any way I might do something for them?"
"I don't know," George Winston admitted.
"Could you find out? If you know about them, could you find out? They have children, do they not? I can pay for their education. Set up a fund of some sort, could I not?"
"Probably not, Irvin, but I can look into it," the Sectrez said, making a note on his desk.
This would be a real pain in the ass for some security people, but there might well be a way, through some D.C. law firm, probably, to double-blind it. It pleased Winston that Irvin wanted to do this. Noblesse oblige was not entirely dead.
"So, you sure you're okay, pal?"
"Thanks to them, yes, George, I am."
"Great. Thanks. Good to hear your voice, pal. See you next time I come over to Europe."
"Indeed, George. Have a good day."
"You too. Bye."
Winston switched buttons on his phone. Might as well check into this right away.
"Mary, could you get me Ed Foley over at the CIA?"
Chapter 10 Diggers. Popoff hadn't done this in ages, but he remembered how. His employer had been written about more than many politicians, which was only just, Popoff thought, as this man did far more important and interesting things for his country and the world. But these articles were mainly about business, which didn't help Popoff much beyond a further appreciation of the man's wealth and influence. There was little about his personal life, except that he'd been divorced. A pity of sorts. His former wife seemed both attractive and intelligent, judging by the photos and the appended information on her. Maybe two such intelligent people had difficulty staying together. If so, that was too bad for the woman, the Russian thought. Maybe few American men liked having intellectual equals under their roof. It was altogether too intimidating for the weak ones, and only a weak man would be troubled by it, the Russian thought. But there was nothing to connect the man with terrorists or terrorism. He'd never been attacked himself, not even a simple street crime, according to the New York Times. Such things did not always make the news, of course. Perhaps an incident that had never seen the light of day. But if it had been so major as to change the course of his life, it would had to have become known, wouldn't it?
Probably.
Almost certainly, he thought. But almost was a troubling qualifier for a career intelligence officer. This was a man of business, a genius both in his scientific field and in running a major corporation. There, it seemed, was where his passions went. There were many photos of the man with women,
rarely the same one twice, while attending various charity or social functions. All nice women, to be sure, Popoff noted, like fine trophies, to be used and mounted on the wall in the appropriate empty space, while he searched after another. So, what sort of man was he working for? Popoff had to admit that he really didn't know, which was more than troubling. His life was now in pawn to a man whose motivations he didn't understand. In not knowing, he could not evaluate the operational dangers that attached to himself as a result. Should the purpose be discerned by others, and his employer discovered and arrested, then he, Popoff, was in danger of arrest on serious charges. Well, the former KGB officer thought, as he returned the last of the periodicals to the clerk, there was an easy solution to that. He'd always have a bag packed, and two false identities ready to be used. Then, at the first sign of trouble, he'd get to an international airport and be off to Europe as quickly as possible, there to disappear and make use of the cash he'd banked. He already had enough to ensure a comfortable life for a few years, perhaps longer if he could find a really good investment counselor. Disappearing off the face of the earth wasn't all that hard for one with proper training, he told himself, walking back out on Fifth Avenue. All you needed was 15 or 20 minutes of warning. Now, how could he be sure to get that? The German federal police were as efficient as ever, Bill Tawney saw. All 6 of the terrorists had been identified within 48 hours, and while detailed interviews of their friends, neighbors, and acquaintances were still underway, the police already knew quite a lot, and had forwarded it to the Austrians, from there to the British Embassy in Vienna, and from there to Hereford. The package included a photo and blueprints of the home owned by Fürtner and Dortmund. One of the couple, Tawney saw, had been a painter of moderate talent. The report said that they'd sold paintings at a local gallery, signed, of course, with a pseudonym. Perhaps they'd become more valuable now, the 6 man thought idly, turning the page. They'd had a computer there, but the documents on it were not very useful. One of them, probably Fürtner, the German investigators thought, had written long political diatribes, appended, but not yet translated. Dr. Bellow would probably want to read them, Tawney thought. Other than that, there was little remarkable. Books, many of them political in character, most of them printed and purchased in the former DDR. A nice TV and stereo system, and plenty of records and CDs of classical music. A decent, middle-class car, properly maintained, and insured through a local company, under their cover names Siegfried and Hannah Kolb. They'd had no really close friends in their neighborhood, had kept largely to themselves, and every public aspect of their lives had been in Ordnung, thus arousing no comment of any kind. And yet, Tawney thought, they'd sat there like coiled springs. Awaiting what? What had turned them loose? The German police had no explanation for that. A neighbor reported that a car had visited their house a few weeks before. But who had come, and to what purpose, no one knew. The tag number of the car had never been noted, nor the make, though the interview transcript said that it had been a German-made car, probably white or at least light in color. Tawney couldn't evaluate the importance of that. It might have been a buyer for a painting, an insurance agent, or the person who had brought them out of cover and back into their former lives as radical left-wing terrorists. It was not the least bit unusual for this career intelligence officer to conclude that there was nothing he could conclude, on the basis of the information he had. He told his secretary to forward Fürtner's writing to a translator for later analysis by both himself and Dr. Bellow. and that was about as far as he could go. Something had roused the two German terrorists from their professional sleep, but he didn't know what. The German federal police could conceivably stumble across the answer, but Tawney doubted it. Fechner and Dortmund had figured out how to live unobtrusively in a nation whose police were pretty good at finding people. Someone they'd known and trusted had come to them and persuaded them to set off on a mission. Whoever it had been had known how to contact them, which meant that there was some sort of terror network still in existence. The Germans had figured that out, and a notation on their preliminary report recommended further investigation through paid informants, which might or might not work. Tawney had devoted a few years of his life to cracking into the Irish terrorist groups, and he'd had a few minor successes, magnified at the time by their rarity. But there had long since been a Darwinian selection process in the terrorist world. The dumb ones died, and the smart ones survived. And after nearly 30 years of being chased by increasingly clever police agencies, the surviving terrorists were themselves very clever indeed, and the best of them had been trained at Moscow Center itself by KGB officers. Was that an investigative option? Tawney wondered. The new Russians had cooperated somewhat, but not very much in the area of terrorism, perhaps because of embarrassment over their former involvement with such people. Or maybe because the records had been destroyed, which the Russians frequently claimed, and Tawney never quite believed. People like that destroyed nothing. The Soviets had developed the world's foremost bureaucracy, and bureaucrats simply couldn't destroy records. In any case, seeking cooperation from the Russians on such an item as this was too far above his level of authority, though he could write up a request, and it might even percolate a level or two up the chain before being quashed by some senior civil servant in the Foreign Office. He decided that he'd try it anyway. It gave him something to do, and it would at least tell the people at Century House, a few blocks across the Thames from the Palace of Westminster, that he was still alive and working. Tawney slid all the papers, including his notes, back into the thick manila folder before turning to work on the foredoomed request. He could only conclude now that there still was a terror network, and that someone known to its members still had the keys to that nasty little kingdom. Well, maybe the Germans would learn more, and maybe the data would find its way to his desk. If it did, Tawney wondered, would John Clark and Alistair Stanley be able to arrange a strike of their own against them? No, more likely, that was a job for the police of whatever nation or city was involved, and that would probably be enough. You didn't have to be all that clever to bag one. The French had proven that with Carlos, after all. Ilyich Ramirez Sanchez was not a happy man, but the cell in the La Santé prison was not calculated to make him so. Once the most feared terrorist in the world, he'd killed men with his own hand, and done it as casually as zipping his fly. He'd once had every police and intelligence service in the world on his trail, and laughed at them all from the security of his safe houses in the former Eastern Europe. There, he'd read press speculation on who he really was and for whom he'd really worked, along with KGB documents on what the foreign services were doing to catch him. Until Eastern Europe had fallen, and with it the nation-state support for his revolutionary acts. And so he'd ended up in Sudan, where he'd decided to take his situation a little more seriously. Some cosmetic surgery had been in order, and so he'd gone to a trusted physician for the surgery, submitted to the general anesthesia, and awakened aboard a French business jet strapped down to a stretcher with a Frenchman saying, "Bonjour, Monsieur Chacal," with the beaming smile of a hunter who'd just captured the most dangerous of tigers with a loop of string. Tried, finally, for the murder of a cowardly informant and two French counterintelligence officers in 1975, he'd defended himself with panache, he thought. Not that it mattered, except to his own capacious ego. He'd proclaimed himself a professional revolutionary to a nation that had had its own revolution 200 years before, and didn't feel the need for another. But the worst part of it was being tried as a criminal, as though his work hadn't had any political consequences. He'd tried hard to set that aside, but the prosecutor hadn't let go, his voice dripping with contempt in his summation. Actually worse than that, because he'd been so matter-of-fact in the presentation of his evidence, saving his contempt for later. Sanchez had kept his dignity intact throughout, but inwardly he'd felt the pain of a trapped animal, and had to call on his courage to keep his mien neutral at all times. And the ultimate result had hardly been a surprise. The prison had already been 100 years old on the day of his birth, and was built along the lines of a medieval dungeon. His small cell had but a single window, and he was not tall enough to see out the bottom of it. The guards, however, had a camera and watched him with it 24 hours a day, like a very special animal in a very special cage. He was as alone as a man could be, allowed no contact with other prisoners, and allowed out of his cage only once per day for an hour of exercise in a bleak prison yard. He could expect little more for the remainder of his life, Carlos knew, and his courage quailed at that. The worst thing was the boredom. He had books to read, but nowhere to walk beyond the few square meters of his cage. And worst of all, the whole world knew that the jackal was caged forever, and could therefore be forgotten. Forgotten? The entire world had once feared his name. That was the most hurtful part of all. He made a mental note to contact his lawyer. Those conversations were still privileged and private, and his lawyer knew a few names to call. "Starting up," Malloy said. Both turboshaft engines came to life, and presently the four-bladed rotor started turning. "Crummy day," Lieutenant Harrison observed over the intercom. "Been over here long?" Malloy asked. "Just a few weeks, sir." "Well, sonny, now you know why the Brits won the Battle of Britain. Nobody else can fly in this shit." The Marine looked around. Nothing else was up today. The ceiling was less than 1,000 feet, and the rain was coming down pretty hard. Malloy checked the trouble board again. All the aircraft systems were in the green. "Roger, Colonel." "Sir, how many hours in the Nighthawk?" "Oh, about 700. I like the Pavlo's capabilities a little better, but this one does like to fly." "About time for us to see that, sonny." Malloy pulled up on the collective, and the Nighthawk lifted off, a little unevenly in the gusting 30-knot winds. "Y'all okay back there?" "Got my barf bag," Clark replied, to Ding's amusement. "You know a guy named Paul Johns?" "Air Force Colonel, down at Eglin. He retired about 5 years ago." "That's the man." "How good is he?" Clark asked, mainly to get a feel for Malloy. "None better in a helo, especially a Pavlo. He just talked to the airplane, and it listened to him real nice. You know him, Harrison?" "Only by reputation, sir," the co-pilot replied from the left seat. "Little guy. Good golfer, too. Does consulting now, and works on the side with Sikorsky. We see him up at Bragg periodically." "Okay, baby, let's see what you got." Malloy reefed the chopper into a tight left turn. "Huh, nothing handles like a 60. Damn, I love these things. Okay, Clark, what's the mission here?" "The range building.
Simulate a zipline deployment. Covert or assault?
Assault, John told him.